This program brought to you by Vanderbilt University. You can find more audio and video on our website, vanderbilt.edu/news.
Welcome to everyone. Welcome to the writing studio if you've not been here before, and welcome to the second of this year's on writing series. And actually, Professor Tishy was our guest the first time around. On writing is a program, for those of you who don't know, where we invite professional writers of various sorts to share with us their experiences of writing, their habits, their idiosyncrasies, and whatnot. And here at the writing studio, we know that different people have very different writing processes, habits, and interests. So it's with this awareness in mind that we try to invite people from a variety of fields and a variety of different writing experiences. So today, it's an honor to have with us Amy Griffith, now Graydon, added on. Amy completed her undergraduate degree at Miami University in Ohio. From there, she moved to Connersville, Indiana, where she worked as a business writer and editor at the News Examiner. More recently, Amy has covered business for the Nashville City Paper, and she's currently working the public education beat for the Nashville City Paper and NashvillePost.com. So please welcome me in, join me, don't welcome me, I'm already here. Please join me in welcoming Amy Griffith. So welcome, Amy. And for those of you who haven't been to one of these events before, what we'll do is we'll start by having a conversation back and forth, and then we will open up the floor for you all to ask Amy questions about specific writing projects or writing in general. So Amy, I thought that we could just start by talking about how it is that you came to be a journalist. What made you pick this career path?
Cool. Well, thanks so much for all of you for having me and for coming in. I hope it's interesting. And I came to journalism because I really didn't like anything else. And I love the pace of it. I love being out in the world, and I love having a new experience every day. I kind of feel like I haven't had to choose what I want to be when I grow up, because I get to do something different every single day. And so I actually had the idea of working for a paper when I graduated from college and wanted to be a fiction writer, and found the livelihood as well as the self-discipline involved to be very daunting. And I said, you know, I'm really not prepared to do this. Hey, if I work for a newspaper, I can get paid to write, and maybe I'll become a much better writer. And so if I am ever ready to make that leap toward working independently without deadlines, then maybe I'll be better prepared. And so I got my first job in Connersville, and absolutely fell in love with the whole process, fell in love with the role journalism plays in government. And it was a small community, but in small communities, journalism is less competitive, but all the more important, because oftentimes the reporter is the one who knows more about local government than the local politicians do. And so anyway, absolutely loved it. Then moved to Nashville and found it extremely difficult to break into papers here. So decided in the meantime to explore a couple of other things that I might be interested in. You know, who knows, maybe it would be an easier way to go. And just didn't find anything I loved nearly as much. And So I realized I really needed to be in journalism when I was working as an advocate for people without health insurance, and just found it so fulfilling, but realized that even working for this cause I believed in so much wasn't as gratifying for me as working for the cause of informing people to make up their own minds about things. And so here I am at the City Paper. I've worked here for 2 years, and it's a locally owned paper, and so it's, you know, they give us a lot of freedom to investigate things and to find our own voices as writers, so it's been a great experience.
Good. So I was actually going to ask you for how many people have read the City Paper or NashvillePost.com? Okay. So not everyone. So could you describe a little bit about those publications for people who don't know?
Yeah. In Nashville, the main daily paper is the Tennessean, which most people have probably seen, and it's owned by Gannett, and Gannett also owns all the other local papers in the area, except for the few that have been started up as independents. So, and then the Nashville Scene is another paper in Nashville, and that's owned by Village Voice Media in New York, and the Scene is great, but it's also not locally owned anymore, but Anyway, the city paper is locally owned by people who wanted to have, you know, a small local business running the news, and they have poured so much money into making that happen and lost so much money in making that happen. So let's hope they keep doing it. But so the city paper, it aims to provide free investigative information, and we try to cover local politics very thoroughly. And typically, our readership is a mix of people who don't want to pay to subscribe to a newspaper and people who follow politics so closely that they really want to see the daily coverage of the nitty-gritty of what's happening with Metro government and Metro schools and the State House. So, and then recently, a few months ago, the city paper was purchased by another local company called Southcom, and it owns NashvillePost.com. And NashvillePost.com is a website that people pay to subscribe to, and it's geared toward politicians and investors who are willing to pay for breaking business and political news. So those two companies are now one. And so we try to provide intelligent, fast breaking news. We only break news. We don't, you know, people haven't lost money on the city paper so that we can write what everyone else writes the same day. I mean, if it's not breaking, we don't print it. So I love it. I couldn't ask for a better journalism experience.
Well, since you've talked about the fact that you work on breaking news, especially, I was wondering, you know, how do you, in academic writing, a lot of times if we're still in school, we're assigned topics, mm-hmm. or we're working in a field that we've been working in for a long time, and we kind of know what the topics are. How do you find or choose your stories?
By talking to a lot of people, like a lot. I feel like all I do is hang out with people. I mean, you know, I have a friend who's a reporter who called herself a glorified gossip, and I'm afraid it often is like that. But for me, it involves just casting my net as wide as I can and talking to as many people from as many different perspectives as I can. And that includes the people in politics. That includes, you know, for me, I cover public education. So every chance I get to talk to students and parents and teachers, the teachers union, I take it. And you know, you just try to be out there and talk to them and find out what they're thinking about and what's important to them. And, you know, even if they tell you something that, you know, they say, oh, this is off the record, please don't talk about this. I mean, obviously, you never break that trust, but it lets you know what people are thinking about, and it gives you a sense of what to explore and to look for. And so that's how I do it. And mm-hmm. and I kind of just follow my nose in terms of what I think is interesting. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when you find that intelligent people are all asking the same questions of the system, or gossiping about the same thing, there's usually something going on, and it's fascinating. So I talk to people, and I just try to answer my own questions about what's happening, and I try to be as productive as I can in terms of turning the answers to those questions into stories.
Great. So with those stories, one of the things that I've been interested in these conversations are people's positive experiences of writing, because so often writing is a really painful experience or very laborious or something that we approach with dread. You kind of don't have that luxury because you have to write so much and all the time. But I was wondering still, in terms of those judgments of satisfaction, what makes a story good for you? And so I was wondering if you could talk about that in one or both of two ways. So either what makes it a positive process or experience as you're writing and working on a story, and then at the end of the story, what lets you know that you've got a good product. So goodness in either of those two ways.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. I was actually kind of thinking about this after talking with you before we had this, and thinking it's funny that I ended up getting into journalism, because I loved the craft of writing so much, and I love reading good writing, and I feel that I'm very sensitive to what I think good writing is. Mm-hmm. And that is just what has driven me into wanting to work as a professional writer. But at the city paper, I have so little time for the craft of writing. And I think, and it's okay. I mean, I still love what I do there. But when I think of what makes a good story, I mean, when I spend too much time thinking of how to craft an article well, unless I'm putting that in the context of the information that I've gathered, then I'm doing something wrong. I mean, when I'm writing my best story is when I'm taking the most interesting, colorful, confusing, noteworthy details and structuring them in a way that really conveys what's most important. And so I think, you know, there's a saying that a good writing, well, this isn't a saying, I'm just bumbling it, but I mean, a well-written story is a well-reported story. Mm-hmm. And so the more color, the more details I have, where literally all I have to do is put them in the right order and put some words together and make it simple and clear and easily read, I mean, those are the best stories in my book and at the city paper, because you really just don't have time to string words together. I mean, we have maybe, I mean, an hour and a half for a 700-word story. And so, I mean, you really just have to think very actively about what's most important. So a good question that I often ask myself is, you know, what's the first thing I would tell someone I, you know, think is really an intelligent person? I mean, what's the first thing they'd be interested in the story? I mean, about what I saw or heard, and try to structure the story around that.
Yeah. And that actually leads nicely into next question for you. No, that's perfectly good. So one of the things that we talk a lot about here at the Writing Studio, and I think in writing classes at the university, is process, right? That writing takes a long time, that you should be revising, you know, that it's going to take a lot of work and a lot of time. Mm-hmm. That's not, from what you just said in that story, that's not something that you always get to do. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about how you write differently now. And so I think you've started talking about that, but when we met earlier, Amy said something to me about how she has to start writing in her head before she gets to her computer. So do you mind talking a little bit about what that's like?
Yeah, absolutely. It's, I guess my first step in the writing process is to just think. I mean, and typically I'm reporting outside of my office, so I think on the way home and try to put things in order in my head. Think about what people would consider most interesting, what I consider to be most important. And but if I'm working in my office sometime, I'll take a 5 or 10 minute walk around my office park just to get a change of scenery and just think. And I guess one part of the process in that thinking is, you know, thinking what would be the first thing I would tell someone about. Another thing is, what are people most going to need to know to fully understand what I've seen happen here? And what do I think is going to happen next? And what do I need to say to prepare people for that? So those are some of the questions that I ask myself. And then with the process, you know, like you said, writing is hard. It's so hard. And we all want it to be effortless because good writing seems so effortless. I guess for me, you know, typically the first thing I have figured out in my head is the lead, the first, you know, paragraph, which gets people attention and sets the tone for the rest of the story. If I don't have a lead yet, at my previous job before the city paper, if I didn't have a lead, I'd take a longer walk and think about it. But at the city paper, you can't do that. So what I do at the city paper is I just get to work writing up the nitty-gritty, you know, the details that, you know, you can't really craft perfectly sentences and paragraphs about the details of the budget, you know, which you're putting in there for people who want to know those details and who just want it, you know, quick and succinct, and so that kind of thing. I'll start writing that, and you know, if there's a paragraph that I know how I'm going to say it, then I get it down on paper, and as the story takes shape, then I'll write the lead as it comes to me, because, you know, it has to be done at a certain time. So and then that usually helps me clarify my thoughts. And I often, I have a noisy office, so I'll wear like earplug things to block out the noise, but it also sends a signal to myself that it's time to concentrate. I recently started a policy of not answering the phone anymore when I'm working on stories, which was hard for me because, like I said, talking to people is how I get stories. So, I mean, I when I sit down to write, I sit down to write, and so I think that's my process.
Did you ever, that strikes me as interesting because it seems like you don't allow yourself the indulgence of saying, I have writer's block, right? That's something, is that something that you did before? Would you
totally
say previously to this job that you would have writer's block and now? There's just no time for it.
Yeah, writer's block or not, you need to have the story done. And it needs to, and, you know, people are better served by having a clunky story than they are by not having the information. Yeah. And so I think one thing I've learned is the value of getting something on paper. I mean, I have yet to return to my previous writing process from the city paper, so I have no idea if this experience will translate well, but... yeah, there's no no writer's block. I mean, and so I guess it's kind of a good skill, though, to make myself take the discipline of just writing up the parts that I do know the way that I want to say them, even if I don't know where they'll go or in what order, because at least you're putting pen to paper, so to speak, and clarifying your thoughts.
Well, so now I'd like to shift in a little bit of a different direction and ask, so when I think about journalists, I think about people who ask questions. Mm-hmm. And so... I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the relationship between questions and your writing.
Yeah, I mean, it's all about asking good questions. And, I mean, wow. I guess, yeah, all I do is ask questions.
Yeah. And do you know ahead of time what they'll be? So if you get sent somewhere to interview someone, or if you're going to try and find out about something going on with the school board... how many questions do you have prepared ahead of time? Do you come up with questions on the fly? What's your process for your coming up with your questions?
I think I do my best reporting, and unfortunately my most time-consuming report. So I guess it depends on how much time I have. If I truly have to make a very fast interview, then I will discipline myself to figure out exactly what information I need to have, and you know, just go right through it and try to stick to that. I feel like my best reporting is done when I go in with big questions, like the context of the situation, or why are people talking about this? Why should I not be concerned about this? Because it looks really concerning, you know. And also, though, the other thing is you never know what you don't know. And so if you limit your questions too much, then you'll miss the complexities of what's happening. And with a public school system, you've got the State Department of Education, the Metro Government, school administration, parents, kids—I mean, all these different venues coming together, and there are legal situations. There's educational knowledge, and you know, I do my best to just get the most you know, honest sense of the experience of the person I'm interviewing. But like I said, this is how I often come in late by being too conversational. So yeah. I'll tailor the number of questions I have and my adherence to them to the amount of time that I have. So, but I mean, I feel like my best reporting is done when I'm able to just converse and take those conversations and come up with the best ways to use them in stories, and you know, come up with the most interesting answers I've heard and turn them into stories. Or also, you know, if I hear questions from a lot of people, I'll write a story about it, even if it's, you know, moderately interesting, then I'll still write it because people are wondering. So
one thing that I've been thinking about is something that as lay people we might not always consider, which is this idea of having a beat, right, that you are always covering sort of the same topic. Mm-hmm. And so in Indiana, you didn't quite have the same kind of beat. You got to cover a variety of things in a small area. But here you've covered first the business beat and then the education beat. Could you talk a little bit about what that's like to have a beat?
Yeah. It's, I mean, the size of the paper will determine the extent of the beat. When I worked for a paper in Indiana, it was kind of a rural area where it was the only daily in, I guess, a 4-county area. So I would be given a beat of covering a county and covering everything that happened there, from a local government, features, schools, crime. It was great. I mean, it was very daunting. And I worked a lot. And I put a lot of miles on my car. But it was a good beat for learning what I was interested in and for getting around. And so one day I'd cover a meth bust in the morning and then, you know, go to a school board meeting that evening, and then the next day write a story about a woman who made it into the National Walmart cookbook for her pineapple upside down cake recipe. You know, so I mean, it was good, though. It was a good jump into journal. I was right out of college. I had lots of enthusiasm, and so it was really great. And then here in Nashville, I mean, the city paper limits itself to the metro area. And so our beats at the city paper have classically been divided up into different government areas, education, metro government, state government, courts, and the law. And recently when we merged with the Nashville Post, which is business-centered, I mean, at the city paper, I had covered a business beat, which often focused on business and politics because of what the city paper does. I mean, the Post has 5 different business reporters with a healthcare business beat and that sort of thing. So in terms of covering a beat, I mean, I cover education. The city paper focuses on government, so my focus on education is typically the government's involvement with education. So it's typically public education. Sometimes when folks are getting really involved at TSU or at Vanderbilt or Fisk, then I'll pop in there. But typically my focus is on the school board and politicians getting involved in public schools. And so as I consider my beat, I mean, it's almost like you're, you know, if I were going to write a book about public education in Nashville, then it's like, well, what would be topics for people to think about as they read? I mean, what's relevant in the subject? And so every day you're just kind of adding to that story. So, you know, I try to, within my beat, balance the coverage between, you know, hard government coverage of it with, you know, looks at what's happening in classrooms and things to provide like a well-rounded thing within that beat. So I hope that makes sense.
And I have sort of a follow-up question about this, which is that it seems like somebody who is interested in, say, business might not necessarily be interested in education immediately and vice versa, but you've done both.
Mm-hmm.
So if it, and you don't have a background necessarily in either, right?
Well, I had my undergraduate degree was in English and economics.
Okay, so actually that does work out kind of nicely.
I thought it did.
Okay.
Yeah, and it's but what was funny about the business beat is that I really did not use the economics degree for my business beat nearly as much as I do for my education beat because of all the statistics involved with education. And, you know, business was far more about having behind-the-scenes conversations and relationships than public education is. I mean, it was a real shock to me. So in terms of becoming interested in things, I think typically the more information you get about something, the more fascinating it becomes. And if that's not happening, then that's a bad sign. But, I mean, so, you know, I think as you immerse yourself in any topic, you'll see how it affects people and you'll see how it's relevant. And, you know, especially if you're a reporter, your job is to make people understand how something is relevant. So you're always asking yourself that question and getting yourself engaged. So, yeah, I was concerned before taking on both beats about how interesting they would be for different ways in both cases. But, you know, I wasn't on the job for a week in either one before I suddenly found it to be the most fascinating topic in the world. So I think, yeah, once you're out there and asking questions and thinking about it a lot, it becomes interesting.
Can you tell us a little bit about some of the most interesting stories that you've covered, either in education or for business? Like, what have been some of your favorite stories that made you feel excited about your beat?
Yeah, I guess, well, education has been just, I mean, it's been a roller coaster ride in Nashville for the last year, and the State Department of Education has really taken over the school district in many ways in the last year because the district has failed benchmarks under No Child Left Behind. So I feel proud of the work I did in covering the ways in which the state was integrating itself. And before the state was legally able to take over the school district, I worked really hard at keeping up to date with those officials at what they felt the problems were in Metro schools. Not only were those the first things to be addressed when the state actually did come over, but it was also a really good sign at how the district was succeeding and also failing. You know, people in the community who public education should really be serving best. You know, minority students, low-income families, and special education students. And so it was really fulfilling to get into the nitty-gritty of those things and to write about it. Another ongoing story that has been really interesting to cover has been the school district rezoning troubles over the summer. excuse me. Oh, no, I'm sorry.
No, it's fine.
In July, the school board voted to kind of rezone the school district and to eliminate busing of students from neighborhoods. Okay, previously, Nashville, well, so hard to figure out where to start on this topic, but kids are currently bused from some, like, very mostly African-American, very low-income neighborhoods to schools over in Bellevue, so that they'll, you know, there will be a little bit more diversity in the school, you know, there will be a little bit more mixture among cultures and things, and they'll, you know, just be out there. And but the school board voted over the summer to stop doing that and to have those kids go to schools in their neighborhoods. And the benefit of that is that the kids aren't on the bus for 45 minutes each way, and the benefit is that their parents can now get to the school if they want to. The downside is that every research study ever shows that, you know, kids who are isolated in cultures of poverty stay there. And so there's been this, you know, ongoing tug in the community about this issue, and Nashville has been talking about this for years and years and years, and it gets to the heart of a lot of social situations in Nashville. So that has been really fascinating to cover as the community reacts to that. And then it's one of the most satisfying stories I covered in business, was just a story that I broke long before a lot of people did, which was the Vanderbilt setting up at 100 Oaks. Got a good tip about that one and confirmed it a good month before the Tennessean was able to get any sources on it. So that was really awesome. And so now when I drive past 100 Oaks, a really bizarre part of me feels like I did it somehow. So anyway, so that was probably my most satisfying story on the business beat. And so, good.
Well, now I'd like to talk a little bit about readers. Mm-hmm. And so I have a couple of questions about readers, but the first one is, when you're writing, who do you imagine that you're writing to or that you're writing for? What is the reader that you imagine at the other end?
That's great. I mean, oftentimes I feel like I just write for myself. Like, I mean, what's the most interesting thing going on here? What am I most interested in? Other times I will find myself writing for really great parents I know. I know some great parents who are just really advocates for their kids, and they're just really involved, and they want to know everything, but they don't always have time to, like, go everywhere and talk to everyone. So I'll find myself writing stories for them. The same goes for government figures. I will sometimes find myself writing for Mayor Carl Dean because, like, he says he wants to take over the school system, and he seems really interested in education, but, you know, he's not everywhere, and so he's one person I'll find myself writing for, like, well, this is what people need to be reading if they want to understand education, you know. Those are some people I find myself writing for, but, I mean, for the most part, I really do feel like I write for myself, like I'm my own reader. And I think that happens not only in the writing process, but also in the reporting process, because that's just naturally what happens. And lucky for me, at the City Paper, they're interested in printing stories that I would want to read, which is a good fit. So I've been able to write stories that I would want to read, and it's in line with what the paper wants to print. So.
Okay. And so that actually brings me to a question about ethics, mm-hmm. Which is that it seems like when you're reporting versus writing, that you're dealing with different audiences, right? So that you have multiple responsibilities, I guess. Mm-hmm. You have responsibilities to your readers who need to know things, those good parents, or to Carl Dean, if you're writing for Carl Dean. But you also have responsibilities to your sources as you're writing, and maybe even responsibilities towards your paper itself, which has spent all this money and lost all this money. So how do you keep those ideas in mind as you're writing and as you're working?
Yeah, it's, I mean, no matter how interesting a story is, it should not be printed if it's, you know, unethical or inaccurate. And I mean, that is the simple fact of it. I mean, everything else has to follow those things. And I'm very happy to be in a paper that really truly believes that. So ethics are something we talk about at my office a lot, and I think it's in part because my boss is part of a Society for Journalism Ethics. The other reporters tend to be, you know, idealistic and driven, so we like getting into talks like that, but I guess some of the ethical questions, I mean, I guess one situation in which an ethical question was answered by my paper, well, I guess we'll start with this, but journalism ethics, it's not just following your moral compass. I mean, it's really a body of knowledge, and I mean, it's sets of rules that people who have thought a lot about journalism have agreed to, and so, you know, you apply levels of scrutiny to public officials. An ethical question we've had is how much scrutiny do you apply to business leaders? You know, they weren't elected. They do more to influence Nashville than elected officials. But does that mean that you should write about it if you hear, you know, that their wife was just jailed? You know what I mean? Did they sign up for that? So that's one ethical issue we deal with. Writing about children, we never identify victims of crime under the age of 18. It's something that the police department does as a matter of policy, but it's also something that we do as a matter of ethics. I mean, so even if, I mean, like for instance, there was a case in which a child was molested on a school bus. I didn't cover the story, but it was covered at my paper while I was there. And the nature of the child's disability, as well as her age, played a big part into explaining exactly how the system failed her. But because she was the only person on her bus with that age and that disability, you couldn't really tell the story of how she'd been failed without identifying her. And so this all happened right after I'd started at the city paper, and I was just really pleased that I'd ended up working there when my boss said, then we need to find another way to tell it, you know. And as it turned out, her parents, about 6 months later, became very comfortable talking about it, and the child has since been on the news. She's been in our paper, everyone else's, but, you know, in the meantime, that was a case where even though we had a really good, really important story about how the system had failed, we just had to find another way to cover it other than just going into the nitty-gritty of exactly what happened. And so, I mean, these are the challenges that are posed by these things, and so that's I guess that's an ethical situation. And, yeah. And I guess fact-checking and accuracy also are just, I mean, they couldn't be more important. So I typically tape record everything, and if I have a question in my mind, then I double-check it. Typically, when I quote people, I'll listen to the interview again, and I actually do that while I write up things like nitty-gritty paragraphs, because... And I also make sure that when I write down quotes, I write down the context of the quote, like what was said before and after. And, you know, that's not only ethical to make sure that you note that even though while someone said this particular quote, they also indicated this, you know what I mean? That's not only fair and ethical, it's also a really important way to build sources and trust in people to talk to you later. So, anyway, ethics are a big part of what we do.
Yeah. Well, that's great. And this might be a good time to turn to some of the things that you brought and to ask Amy to talk a little bit about what it's like to work with an editor. And she's brought some different pieces of writing with her. So there's actually two handouts. There's one stapled packet and one single sheet. And then maybe after we discuss that, we'll open for questions.
Yeah, Catherine and I were talking about the revision process. And
I think I gave away.
I actually have two of those.
And we were talking about the revision and editing process, and one adjustment I had to make while working at the city paper was working under these deadlines, I had to do a lot less revising than what I would typically do. Like, I'm a big second drafter. I mean, my typical style is just to get it out roughly and then just spend a lot of time refining. And at the city paper, I still do that, but I also have to know when to turn it over to an editor because they want it as soon as possible so that they can, you know, ask questions if need be, tinker with it if they want. So working for an editor is a huge part of the revision process for me, whether I like it or not. And often they have great suggestions, and often I'm so frustrated by it that I don't even want to read the story the next day. This is a case, this story, in this packet you have a draft of the story as well as the published version of the story. And this is a case in which I initially read the story the next day, and I was like, oh, how could they do it? I hate what they did to the craft of this story. I mean, but now that I was reading it later, I think they made some improvements. So the difference starts with the lead. And when I first wrote my draft, I wrote it rather complexly. You know, the Mayor's Office and Metro Council have authorized full funding for Metro National Public Schools. There's already considerable pressure, in the words of one official, you know, and it's long and wordy and complex. Then the second one, they revised it so that it's Metro National Public Schools' newly minted operating budget is already facing considerable pressure to find $4.7 million for special education bus monitors. Didn't like that they had considerable and random quotes. Felt a little bizarre to me. Didn't like that they hadn't, you know, mentioned that the Mayor's Office and Metro Council had been involved in the funding right off the bat when it was the Mayor's Office that was calling for the school district to do something different. I mean, I just really felt like they had oversimplified. But as I'm reading it now, it's like, well, you know, by the time someone gets through this first whole paragraph, they're probably really bored.
Yeah.
So it was a case where I felt that their restructuring had improved the flow of the story for people who were not as actively and nerdily engaged in Metro politics as I was in writing the story. So, just one example.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other thing that we included is just, I mean, I just
this
thought
sheet.
This was interesting because the blogosphere is a big deal in journalism. I mean, it's a huge deal. And we actually have a full-time blogger who works for us, and he's amazing. I mean, he breaks news every day. And, you know, his goal is to just read everything that comes across the web, and he'll find something that's an important detail that people didn't really frame the story around and put a headline with it. And he'll make a blog post about it. So he'll pick that one detail that's really important and just, you know, take it out of the story and draw everyone's attention to it. And he really advances the news that way. He does an amazing job. But this is a case where I wasn't happy with the blogger, and I wasn't happy with my editor, because my editor added to my story some facts that were not true. In this case, it was as harmless as when the baseball season started. But local bloggers love writing about errors in papers, as they should. I mean, we're all applying scrutiny, we're all receiving scrutiny, and it's fine, but this is a case where I was upset with the editing process because they had added a fact that was incorrect, and the blogger used it to illustrate a complaint he had about the Tennessean. So just included this, just kind of an interesting moment.
Do you want to... does someone want to actually read those first two paragraphs so everybody can see what she's talking about?
Yeah.
Would someone read those out loud?
Anyone? I can read them.
Or would you, Amy,
sure.
Then?
Just try and convince me that the illegal immigration imbroglio is not about race, is not concerned with targeting Hispanics, and is not focused on Mexicans, when I open the Tennessean to see this headline blaring at me and coding illegals in general with the horrendous sin of one. And in Nashville, illegals in general means a specific set of darker-skinned Spanish-speaking people. If this trial concerned an Anglo from Canada or England or Australia, I bet that illegal immigrant appears nowhere in the headline. Absolutely correct. On an unrelated subject, City Paper reporter Amy Griffith shows this morning that she has not done her research on when the Sound season opens. She concludes, "The Sound will open the 2007 season Thursday against the New Orleans Zephyrs, in spite of the ubiquitous news of last Thursday's opening day. But if I were to write a headline about that in the manner of this morning's Tennessean screamer on the Garcia trial, it might run something like this. Girl reporter has Nashville Sounds opening season a week after they actually did an analysis of dead ballpark deal." So the fact that the headline describes Ms. Griffith's ostensible gender and that it has done so with a diminutive has absolutely nothing to do with her error about the Sounds opening day. Likewise, the fact that an individual is an illegal immigrant should have borderline, bearing at best on the news that he is going to plead guilty to the heinous crime of killing two people.
Right.
I completely agree with his argument, and he's absolutely correct, and people do that, and it's, well, I don't mean to get on a soapbox, but it's an unfortunate fact that anytime a headline has the word immigrant in it, web traffic goes crazy in Tennessee, and it's terrible. So I really don't mind his use of my story to illustrate this. I did mind when I got in trouble at my office for having an inaccuracy in my story, and that was on a blog post that was emailed widely, and but it wasn't my hair. So anyway, just a small point. Really just brought it along to illustrate.
But it's an interesting point about what happens with when working with editors is that there are multiple people involved in the stories that come out under your name.
Yeah, exactly. And it's still my name at the top of the story, right. No matter what happens in there. I'm still responsible for it. So oftentimes I'll try to stay until after a story's been edited so that I can read it one more time before it goes in the paper when I can.
Well, actually, I lied a little bit. Let me ask you one more question, yeah. Then we'll open it up to questions for everyone. And you said that you'd do this when we talked earlier. Is there any advice that you'd like to give to people who are interested in careers in journalism who might be here because that's an interest of theirs?
Yeah, I just... it's a wonderful job. It's really hard, and it's competitive, and, long hours, low pay. But seriously, if you think you love it, then do it. And I feel like I was overly daunted about joining journalism before I started because, I did work very hard to break into the city paper and worked a lot of hours, drudge work and things, but it is completely worth it to have a job that I love. So I would just say to people who are interested in journalism, get to know people who work in journalism and... papers are very happy typically to have people work for them for free as interns or whatever works for you. If you don't want to do that, then or if you can't do that or if you haven't done that and you're already out of school, you can email a reporter that you admire and ask them to lunch or just get engaged there or do what I did, which is get a job at a small newspaper and learn a whole lot. And because the nice thing about journalism is that people do judge you by your clips, by your actual work. They can actually see in front of them what you've done. And so if you have good clips, they can get you pretty far once you know people. That's the other side of journalism, unfortunately, that it's also a relationship game in many ways. So that's why it's important to get out there and try to meet people in your local market, because I've seen all too many job searches where the job search consists of asking people's friends who's looking for work. But anyway, if you can build up good clips and also make local contacts, then there's no reason why you cannot engage in this difficult but wonderful profession. So there you go.
And that's so helpful. Thank you. And so now does anyone else have questions for Amy? I've gotten to ask lots. Yeah, Valen.
I'm not sure how to phrase this. I have a question kind of about hierarchy in the journalism world, because it kind of sounds like in some ways you're answering to your editor and that they're the changes that they want go. But then when they make a mistake or put something in that's inaccurate, I'm wondering if you have any recourse if even the correction that they print later, does that say that your name, or does it say that an editor made that addition? And then does that give you more control over future articles, or is there just kind of the hierarchy of it?
Yeah, in terms of my getting in trouble when I came into the office, that was quickly taken care of when we all realized what had happened, and I still had the draft on my desk, and it was done by a guy I really like. Everyone makes errors, including editors, and so I was no longer in trouble with my boss when that happened. But the correction had my name in it, and that's just, if it's a story by me, it's a story by me. So it's just how it goes. So and I didn't write to the blogger and say, I didn't make this error, because, immaterial. So, I guess hierarchy, I work in a newsroom, fortunately, where, they just really value getting the correct information out, and that's just all there is to it, so.
So kind of a team sport where everyone takes the blame and everyone reaps the benefits when it's successful?
I think so. In the office, I definitely had no scars after that situation. Out of the office, no one would know, But it's funny to balance what people think of you in the office with what people think of you outside the office, because they both have to be there, It has to happen both ways. But Again, though, I harbor absolutely no ill feelings toward the editor in question in this case, because errors happen. I mean, it's horrible, but they happen, and they kill you when they do happen. Like, I mean, I would have to think hard to tell you my very favorite stories that I've written, but I could tell you every single error that I've made. Mm-hmm. I really think that, because it can keep you from falling asleep worrying that there's something you got wrong in a story. But as long as the bulk of your work is accurate and you're working hard, then at least my editors, you know, take the full spectrum into account. Mm-hmm. But I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, that does. I have one unrelated question as well. You said that you don't answer phones while you're working on the story, and that strikes me as a really positive just decision to make. But does it concern you that what if last minute information is coming in?
Valerie, you're going to ruin her system.
No, it drives me crazy. I've only been doing the no phone system for a month. and I mean, Ben, my new husband, can tell you that I work very long hours, and I've tried to trim that back in the last month. I mean, but you know, after a school board meeting, as soon as we all leave, I will get, you know, four or five different people calling me on my cell phone to tell me off the record what I should have been able to catch, you know, and they'll want to gossip about it, and they'll want to talk about it. They're glad someone's interested, you know, and so, you know, I just have to strike the right balance between doing what I need to do to meet my deadlines and not get burnt out with also making very sure, because I mean, if I'm writing a story and I have caller ID on my phone at the office and on my cell phone, so if I see a number come up where it's involving a person who's in the story, I will answer it.
Okay.
Even if I'm thinking, you know, but like you say, I mean, if it's information related to the story, then it needs to be in the story. And but it's always hard, though, because the story keeps changing, you know, even after I write it and finish it keeps changing, and so it can bog you down, but I hope that helps.
Yeah, I think I worked in journalism briefly, and so I think I'm having you answer all of my insecurities about journalism.
Oh, no!
Okay, cool. Any other questions?
We notice in TV news reporting, so often, it's a black reporter covering black mm-hmm. figures, mm-hmm. politics, and so on. I mean, you obviously have been doing very well, or you wouldn't be at the City Paper when the merger also included mm-hmm. five business reporters. And so here you are with a new beat that involves a lot of, I should think, much more engagement with people in different race, I mean, across the race line and different ethnicities. Have you ever felt that you were getting less than you needed because of information or even conjecture because you were talking across those lines of race and ethnicity?
That's a great question. And I was thinking about this on Tuesday. I was assigned during the presidential election day. I got the absolutely awesome assignment of spending my time at voter precincts in North and East Nashville. And let me tell you, it was a beautiful day to be at those precincts, because if you're a Democrat or a Republican, I mean, there were veterans of the civil rights movement there. There were, you know, people saying that they had never thought that they'd see this day come. And you know, it was really cool. But in terms of the you know, African-American reporter covering African-American stories, I mean, you see it on TV, and it's at the Tennessean, too. They have a diversity reporter who's a young black woman, and she's, I mean, she does a really good job, but if there's a story involving schools that involves racial tension, they send her out there, even though she doesn't have the same public education context. And I actually feel, first of all, I feel so fortunate that people here are very welcoming, but I feel like if you are knowledgeable enough and earnest enough to just look someone in the eye and just convince them that you really want to understand their experience, and then they'll tell you. I mean, watching the school board, there have been times when I had first started covering the school board, and I observed that for different votes, all the black members of the board who were of a certain age, the age beyond which that meant that they had attended segregated schools, they would vote one way, and everyone else on the board would vote another way. And I had to suck it up and ask one of them why, you know. But the fact that I was interested made him willing to trust me. And, I mean, it was really amazing. On Tuesday, I covered a Baptist church on Jefferson Street had a rally for Obama at their church in Fish Fry, and I was definitely the only person there who was not black, definitely the only person there who wasn't part of this particular community. And but the minister there, who I had worked with in covering rezoning, he said, "Hey, you're home here." And it was really amazing. I mean, he couldn't have said a nicer thing, because I feel so self-conscious covering these stories, like I must be missing so much. But they, so they've been very welcoming. If you're interested in hearing about it, then people are usually willing to talk about it. And so anyway, that's been my experience so far. But I'm probably just fortunate.
Other questions? We can also have questions over punch and cookies and tapenade, if people would like to do that way. Would you like that?
That sounds great.
Okay, so punch and cookies and tapenade.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you very much for coming here. And thank you, Amy.
Thank you, guys.